Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
One of the president's ride or die defenders is legal advisor Jenna Ellis.
It's such a political prosecution and a political persecution.
Quote,
this to me is a clear violation of the Fourth Amendment. It's revisionist originalism. Tolerance just isn't a two-way street with the Democrats. And I think that tells you all we need to know.
Newsmax contributor and former legal counsel to President Trump.
Jenna Ellis.
Well, it is a great day and a good morning to be rational, considered people. And we should always be rational, considered, analytical people when we call ourselves conservatives, and especially when we call ourselves Christians. And this should go for any news story or really any situation that we have to analyze and fact gather first before rendering an opinion or a judgment. But in the social media kind of court of public opinion landscape, often this becomes not a matter of fact-finding. It becomes a matter of sort of a knee-jerk reaction, and opinions just spread like wildfire, and you are perceived to be more virtuous if you have a very strong opinion versus whether or not you actually have a reasoned, sound judgment. And I think this is a very dangerous situation for our culture. And there was no greater evidence of this than yesterday when the Project Veritas story just went wild. And James O'Keefe, who of course is the founder of Project Veritas, when he put out a 45-minute video explaining why he resigned from Project Veritas and why essentially in his view he was being forced out, and he had all of his reasons, which he submitted to the group of staffers that he was speaking to, and then of course that was recorded and so put out by video. And the board of directors, in my view, has been really, really losing the PR game. And they have been silent for the last about 2.5 weeks that this story has kind of been unfolding, when we've known that James O'Keefe has been put on temporary leave, but really didn't know why. So finally, yesterday evening, around 7 o'clock, the board of directors issued a statement basically saying, and it was kind of long-winded, I got bored reading it, frankly, but the statement essentially said that the board had no choice because there were financial improprieties and financial malfeasance, that because of the status of Project Veritas as a nonprofit, James O'Keefe was using some of the nonprofit funds for personal use, and they are undergoing an audit and seeing whether those funds that he claimed were for donor meetings and other things were actually for personal use. So these are two wildly, dramatically different stories and reasons from James O'Keefe and from Project Veritas. And both have the possibility of being true, and both cannot simultaneously be true, right? So where does that leave us? Well, in a considered world, having considered judgment, if we are reasonable jurors in the court of public opinion, then we will fact find first, and we will say, wow, these are two dramatically different stories, and I want to see the receipts. I want to see what actually comes forward from the board of directors and their allegations here, because this is a colorable claim. This is something that obviously they are taking seriously. But also we know that James O'Keefe has been an excellent journalist until now. We have had no reason to distrust him. So this puts us in kind of an analysis of the facts and also the credibility of both of these claimants. And the problem that I have with the response here is that so many people want to simply bolster the credibility of James O'Keefe that they are perfectly fine with absolutely slamming the board of directors and some of its members by name and suggesting that they, for all kinds of different reasons, are simply out to get James O'Keefe. They've been taken over by Pfizer. I mean, all kinds of conspiracy theories that the board itself and even James O'Keefe isn't even alleging. But a lot of people are inputting their own analysis and speculation into this, rather than taking a step back and saying, is it possible that someone even as respected in the journalistic community like James O'Keefe could have committed this type of malfeasance? Well, yes, that's possible. So on Twitter yesterday, of course, knowing both of these people, I mean, I was at a dinner a couple of weeks ago sitting next to James O'Keefe. I know one, at least, of the board of directors personally for years. He's been on this program. And I know a lot of other staff at Project Veritas. I have no stake in this personally. I'm not, you know, paid by them. I don't have a financial stake in this venture or anything like that. But I do have relationships with them. And even so, the personality cult of people who simply would prefer to say that they know for sure that one side or the other is accurate and truthful, and they're totally fine with slamming the other side, and anyone who would dare simply say, let's step back and wait for the facts to unfold, let's wait to see the receipts, that somehow that is an evil, arbitrary, traitorous position, is kind of where we've gotten ourselves to in this culture of kind of the, you know, Phil Donahue, Geraldo Rivera kind of just public opinion and opinion from anyone who haven't really analyzed anything that's going on here. I mean, my parents actually always like to talk about the old shows of Phil Donahue, how instead of having people on who actually have something to say and have an opinion based on fact or experience even or expertise, you know, he just pulls the audience and he goes, you know, hey, what do you, you know, person sitting in the third row, what do you think about this? And who, why do we care? Why do we care what the person who has no idea what's going on in the situation, has no stake in anything that's going on, and is just some random audience member who's watching this show for really entertainment purposes, what they think? Well, that's become our court of public opinion. And I have used this situation on Twitter, which I'm being totally lambasted today for being a rational, reasonable person, and I'm completely fine with that, because I will always take the rational, reasoned position, and I would love for our court of public opinion and our social media landscape and our news media, opinion-driven media landscape, to be able to say, we don't know right now. I'm often asked, I mean, in literally every media situation that I'm on, I'm always asked for my opinion. And sometimes it's just from my opinion as a conservative. It's my opinion as a Christian. It's my opinion as a lawyer. Sometimes it's my opinion based on knowledge of facts that I was privy to, like when I represented the 45th president of the United States. But in all of those different situations, there are times when it's really okay to say that the best response is, I don't know yet. Let's wait and see. Let's be reasoned jurors and actually have a standard of proof that we require from both sides here before we submit our judgment. But the court of public opinion right now has no standard of proof. They're not even close to beyond a reasonable doubt. They're not even close to a scintilla of evidence, right? They are just a cult personality following that if you, like me, dare to say, well, it's possible that the board of directors had a point here, then all of a sudden, you're the worst person in the world. You're slamming James O'Keefe. You are a traitor to the conservative movement. How dare you? And I would say to that, why can't we just be reasonable? Why can't we demand that the evidence has to be there and actually show something so that we can render a considered judgment? But the court of public opinion is just so beyond ridiculous at this point that I don't know. I mean, maybe we are past reason and analysis on forums like Twitter. But while Twitter still exists and while Elon Musk has done a really good job taking it over, I will be a voice of reason to consider judgment. And I will take the slings and arrows from people suggesting that, you know, somehow the cult personality following, how dare you, Jenna, and actually ask people to come back to a position of rationality and to say, you know, that not taking a position is siding with fact-finding and truth over just my friends, one side or the other. And I don't know where we got to as a Christian society. And by that, I mean, you know, the larger swath of evangelical Christians, not, you know, American society as a whole, but how we got to the Christian understanding that somehow it is better and more virtuous to immediately defend and side with your friends regardless of anything. And that is what a faithful friend is. That is not what the Bible suggests at all. That's not what the Bible commands. I mean, in fact, Proverbs 18:17 talks about how the first person to speak sounds like he's in the right until someone else comes along and questions him. Questioning is good. Questioning and asking for evidence is a very, very good thing. So as you are analyzing this Project Veritas story, which of course is going to have wide ripple effects in the whole conservative landscape of journalism and implicates a lot of other things, I would respectfully suggest that we wait and we see, and I think it is incumbent upon the board of directors to show their hand and show their receipts and back up their claims as soon as possible so that we, the jury and the court of public opinion, can then determine what we actually think. And is it possible that the board of directors is overreacting, that there was some other nefarious motive? Of course that's possible. And is it possible that they had a legitimate reason as a nonprofit to be very concerned about a huge level of financial malfeasance? Absolutely. And it's wild to me that some of the responses to the board of directors' statements were, you know, James O'Keefe has done such a good job, who cares? Or he founded the organization, so the money should all be his. Well, that is not how nonprofits work. And it just shows that people are so defensive, they're not even rational at this point. So that's my take. And I think that we really, really, really need to, as Christians, be rational, have wisdom, and be willing to say, I don't have an opinion yet. I would like to wait for the facts. I don't know. That is perfectly okay. All right, let's get to our first guest, who is standing by, my good friend Mike Donnelly. You all know him from Yes Every Kid Foundation, and he is an advocate for school choice and the wider growth of school choice. And of course, he would, I think he's starting to term school choice a little bit differently. But we want to talk about the subject of ESAs, and that's kind of gotten a little bit of a controversial topic. So Mike, welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Hey, Jenna. Controversial?
Yes, ESAs are. Isn't that interesting? Uh-oh. And I'm bringing you on with only about a minute left before we go to break. So obviously you're going to stay on into the next segment.
Of course.
Let's talk just in 30 seconds. Give me the description of the landscape of why ESAs are potentially controversial.
Well, ESAs are a growing policy choice across the country. You're seeing many, many governors and legislatures passing them. You have ESAs in a lot of different countries. Education Savings Accounts is what ESA stands for. And it's basically an account that some people are able to apply for from the government, and they receive a government deposit, a deposit of government funds into that account that they're able to use for the education of their child, whether that's to go to a private school or in many cases to do individualized learning. So that's the ESA. And, there's a lot of people doing it. So, controversy, maybe there is some controversy about it, but maybe the controversy really is, how are we going to fix education in America? To me, that's the bigger question.
Yes, that is the bigger question. And I would agree with that. And so we will talk about this more when we come back right here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. I'm talking with Mike Donnelly, who is from Yes Every Kid Foundation. You are not going to want to miss this conversation. We'll be right back.
What could healthcare sharing mean to you? Well, if you're like a lot of people who switch to MediShare, honestly, it's a huge relief. Like for the parents of an 8-year-old girl fighting cancer, it's confidence they have in having a community praying for them and paying their medical bills so they can focus on just being there and loving their daughter. Or for a young couple getting ready to welcome their first child into the world, it's being able to be in the moment, getting to enjoy this great gift from God without worrying about medical bills. And it's a relief these days to know you can actually save some money on something. The typical family saves $500 a month by switching to MediShare. And it's a ministry. When you call them, you talk to actual humans who want to help you. So that's a relief too. MediShare has been around 30 years. It's affordable, reliable healthcare. It's a great time to switch to. Call now. 833-44-BIBLE. That's 833-44-BIBLE. 833-44-BIBLE.
The following is not an actor, but a real-life story from Trinity Debt Management.
I'm Corey, and this is my story. I was going through some financial troubles paying off my credit cards. I was paying high interest rates, and it just wasn't getting any better. And I knew I had to do something. So my mom told me about Trinity, and so I decided to call. Trinity was able to do something that I couldn't. I'm paying off my debt, I'm saving thousands, and things are really looking up. I promise you guys, you will not regret it when you call Trinity, because it was such a relief and less stress in my life, and it was the best thing I could have done for myself, because once I called Trinity, they took care of me and I felt such a relief, a weight off my shoulders, and they are a Christian-based company. I love it.
If you're in debt and you need help, call Trinity at 1-800-788-1813.
I'm Corey, and I'm debt-free for keeps.
1-800-788-1813.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Stern. Stand by for news and commentary next.
Liberty University's K-12 Online Academy is the best of a homeschool, private school, and Bible-based education all rolled into one. With LUOA, you can take charge of your child's learning environment and create a structured yet flexible schedule that works for your family. Our qualified teachers are easily accessible for guidance and support along the way. And with new classes starting every Monday, it's never too late to make a switch to LUOA. To learn more, text LUOA to 88741. That's LUOA to 88741.
The nation is mourning the loss of Memphis police officer Jeffrey Redd. He was gunned down by a suspect inside a public library on February 2nd, shot in the head. He died over the weekend. Officer Redd was 49 years old, a devoted husband and father and grandfather. A Marine Corps veteran, he was a Christian man in charge of security at Greater Community Temple, a Church of God in Christ congregation. His passing has gone almost unnoticed by the press and the politicians in Memphis. There were no press conferences, just a statement posted on social media, no comment from the NAACP or the professional activist. There were no vigils or marches in the street, and that's a shame. We're helping the Memphis Police Association raise money for Officer Redd's family. We could use your help. You can donate by going to toddstearns.com. Just a small way to let Officer Redd's family know that his life mattered. Blue lives matter. I'm Todd Stearns.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And just before the break, I brought in my good friend Mike Donnelly, who is with Yes Every Kid Foundation, to talk about the choices that we should have in terms of education and protecting parental rights, and this whole concept of an education savings account or an ESA. And of course, you know, these options a lot of people suggest are very, very good. But Mike, the pushback, I think, and where, you know, the controversy, if you want to call it that, lies is that some people are very concerned that any sort of government funded education is problematic. And so if we tie any, especially federal government dollars to ESAs, or even state level dollars to ESAs, then those will come with strings attached.
Well, that's always a concern whenever the government funds something. There's a lot of calls for, you know, they call it accountability or assessment. And, you know, what the government funds, it wants to control. I mean, that's a natural thing. But what we're seeing with the ESAs that are passing around the country, there's not a lot of extra strings attached. Families are having lots of options to use that funding to educate their children. Of course, in Arizona, there was a bit of a dust up. People were a little bit upset about some families using their education savings account to buy a chicken coop, for example. Now, you know, I mean, animal husbandry, you know, does that sound too crazy? I don't know. Do we want to have kids learning things that are interesting and different? Do we want children to pursue things that are interesting to them? I have a chicken coop in my backyard. Of course, in my state, I can't get an ESA to pay for it. I got to pay for it myself. But it's fine. My kids go out there. They learn about chickens and caring for chickens, and that's a good thing.
And you're a millionaire now, probably, because you actually have chickens. So, you know, that's you don't even need an ESA anymore. You've got eggs. That's literally gold these days.
An egg savings account, right? I mean,
yeah,
eggs are so expensive, you know.
There you go.
But, you know, but the point of all this, Jenna, I think, is that what we want to see for education in America is for every child to have an individualized education that meets their individual needs, so that every child is treated as the unique person that they're created by God to be. And it's a bottoms-up kind of a system, not a top-down system, which is the kind of system that we have right now. And so, you know, whether it's an ESA or a tax credit scholarship or a voucher or a deduction, you know, to me, you know, giving parents more choices, and at Yes Every Kid Foundation, we feel that parents need to have more choices. And this is just one area. Funding is just one area where we hope people can start thinking differently about how we do education so we can transform it so that it can meet the needs of every child. That, to me, that's what we really need to do.
I'm talking with Mike Donnelly, who is with Yes Every Kid Foundation, and that makes a lot of sense in terms of just giving a lot of different choices to parents. And so, what is the landscape of ESAs in terms of most of the states? I mean, is this completely widely different in terms of what you can use it for? Can you use it for homeschooling? What should parents who want to take advantage of some of these things maybe be pushing for in legislative solutions in their state?
You know, Jenna, it's a great question. 31 states have some kind of school choice funding program. So, you know, folks, I would encourage folks, if they want to know if they have a program in their state, they can go to a website called edchoice.org, edchoice.org. They've got a great list that you can click on your state. And 31 states have some kind of tax credit or ESA scholarship. And then most of the ESA scholarships are pretty narrow. Arizona actually passed the first universal ESA last year, which meant anybody could qualify for it. And some tens of thousands of people have applied for it, but there are probably a million children in Arizona, so it's still not widely accepted or widely used by people. But as we talked about before, in Arizona, people have a wide range of options to spend the money on. They can take it to a private school. They can educate their children independently in an independent program, kind of like homeschooling. Although in most places where there are ESAs and homeschooling, the rules are a little bit different. So, you know, it really varies in the state, so people should find out in their state. But most states have some kind of funding program that will allow them to do different things with ESAs.
So when you say the rules are different generally for homeschooling, what are some examples of that?
Well, so for example, Arizona, the law requires an assessment to be filed annually, whereas the homeschoolers in Arizona who homeschool under the homeschool law don't do that. So the assessment requirements, the accountability requirements, if you're getting an ESA, you've got to keep receipts and prove that you actually spent the money on the thing that you bought it on. So there is fraud prevention. I mean, people are concerned about that, and there's a small amount of that in any program. You're going to find that. And you were talking about before by James O'Keefe. I thought that was a really good, opening you had there. And, you know, we've got to find out the facts, you know, look at what people are actually doing. Is it really contributing to the education of children? And I would say in most cases, 99% of the time from what we're seeing, it is. What is it we want our kids to learn anyway? You know, you talked about finding facts. I think that's great. What I think we want is kids who can think for themselves. We want to teach our children to grow up and to be able to think for themselves, to think critically, to be able to solve problems and apply themselves and learn. And that's what we're about at Yes Every Kid, is we want that for every child.
Yeah, and that that makes a lot of sense. And so then I think the next question, of course, would be specifically religious education, because, you know, there was also kind of a difference of opinion in terms of the Supreme Court taking up the, I think it was in Maine, correct me if I'm wrong, about, you know, saying that the state funding there, you know, could not be prevented for going to schools that were inherently religious in nature, and some of those parochial schools. And, you know, kind of some of the pushback to that was, well, you know, the states should be able to dictate what this can and can't be used for. And that is a legislative prerogative. But then the Supreme Court said, well, no, you can't discriminate on the basis of faith, which, of course, I think the Christian community at large said, you know, that was a good decision. But is there a potential here then that if states, absent a Supreme Court decision to the contrary, like in Maine, that states could incentivize parents to go to certain options by what they exclude and say, well, we are going to, the strings attached essentially are you can only, you know, spend like if this is in the context of, you know, a grocery budget or, you know, some of those things like welfare. And it's like, well, you can only spend it on certain items. And if but the state never says you have to choose this particular brand of grocery store over another. But it seems like that's what maybe intentionally, maybe unintentionally, that's what they're doing with schools.
Well, that's a great question about Carson v. Macon, which is the Supreme Court's decision on the Maine town tuitioning case, where the Supreme Court basically said, look, you can't exclude someone from the program just because it's a religious school. That violates, you know, the freedom of exercise clause of the First Amendment, which the Supreme Court has chosen to apply to the state through the 14th Amendment. We've talked about that before. But, you know, and you look across the state, and some states do have constitutional amendments that restrict public funding from either going to non-public schools or to religious schools. But in most cases, those constitutions say direct funding. Now, these are the so-called Blaine Amendments, which the Supreme Court has, you know, through Carson v. Macon and through the Espinoza case in Montana, have effectively said, look, you can't treat people differently just because they're religious. That's what the First Amendment, the Supreme Court says the First Amendment means. And so these Blaine amendments in these state constitutions violate the First Amendment of the Supreme Court's interpretation of the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. So they have to be careful. Now, direct funding is different. Like, so the direct funding, if the state is going to directly write a check to a religious school, that they can prohibit. But if you give money to parents or give parents the option to choose, that's not direct funding, because the parents can choose from a wide variety of options. And it's not okay for the government to restrict that. And I'll tell you, this is a developing area. There's an interesting case coming out of the Fourth Circuit. A charter school there has a dress code. And shocker, you know, they want girls to wear skirts and boys to wear pants. I know, very controversial.
Sounds reasonable.
That's the question. Look, I mean, look, you know, it's their school, you know, if the parents agree and, you know, you don't have to go to that school, but... anyway, but the question that the court is being asked to consider, it's a Pelletier case out of Fourth Circuit, South Carolina, is whether a charter school, because this is a charter school, it's whether a charter school for the purposes of the U.S. Constitution is a state actor, and whether, you know, requiring girls to wear skirts and boys to wear pants is a violation of potentially equal protection and treating people equally under the law. And so that's an interesting question. The Supreme Court has not decided to take that case. They've asked the Solicitor General of the United States to give their opinion on the case, and so they're going to wait and hear. But a lot of people I'm talking to think they're going to take that case, and it could have wide ramifications.
That is a really fascinating consideration, and how, you know, we get into sometimes the minutiae of details, and, you know, and especially in the wider context of the difference fundamentally and biologically between boys and girls, men and women. And now, you know, it becomes this sort of, it used to be an equal protection thing that, you know, oh, should girls be treated differently than boys for purposes of dress code? And now it's more, can boys dress like girls if they want to? And that's somehow equal protection. I mean, you know, we've gone, in my opinion, totally jumped the shark in that whole vein. But that will be an interesting of the case if the Supreme Court decides to take it up. And from a constitutional vantage point, and this may be a question outside the scope of what you want to speak on behalf of your organization, but just as, you know, the constitutional professor, constitutional law professor in you, Mike Donnelly, I'm wondering your opinion as well on Thomas Massey, Representative Massey's bill that wants to dissolve the Department of Education by the end of this year. And he's gotten several Republican co-sponsors. And I am a huge fan of this. I think it's an unconstitutional organization. It has absolutely no business being an agency of the federal government and telling the states what to do. But your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, not going to speak on behalf of Yes Every Kid. In my capacity as a constitutionalist, I will say this. And I think the folks at Yes would probably be okay with this because we're about bottoms up solutions, not top down. And the Department of Education is very much top down. So I think we probably don't like that. There's a lot of regulation that comes out of the DOE that influences and makes it harder for schools to provide individualized education for kids. So, you know, we definitely would support more individualized education. But if you look at the Constitution of the United States, you don't see the word education in it anywhere. It's not a delegated authority to Congress. And, you know, my view has always been, you know, Congress should not be passing spending bills for things that are not explicitly given to it as a enumerated power. You know, the general welfare clause is in the preamble of the Constitution. And, you know, the Supreme Court says Congress can spend money on anything they want, but that doesn't mean they should. And I think Congress should restrain itself and only fund things that are enumerated in the Constitution. I think we'd have a lot more freedom and a lot more limited government if they would restrain themselves. And so if that were true, you know, there would be no Department of Education because education is a state responsibility. It's not a federal responsibility. And the only way the states have to comply with those regulations is because they accept the money. This is the way the federal government often gets states to go along with what they want, is through their spending powers, right? They'll say, you can get this money if you do this or if you do that. They did that with highway funding back in the 70s. That's how they got all the states or many of the states to raise the drinking age to 21, which everybody wanted. And it's fine if you're okay with that, but it was 18, then it was 21, and different places had it when it was 19 and whatever. But the federal government incented states to do that by conditioning the receipt of highway funds on that. So that's how it works. And I don't like that. I don't think that's the way we should operate in a republic. I think states should do what states are supposed to do. Federal government should do what it's supposed to do. And that's it.
Yeah, and I would agree with you, obviously, on the constitutional part of that, and that because education isn't in the language of the Constitution, very clearly, it's not an enumerated power, as you said, and if states can spend money on it, then the federal government can't. And that's why we have a separation of powers, not just on the horizontal level of the federal government between the three different branches, but we also have it vertically, and that's called federalism. And we do need to have a willingness to also embrace a diversity of opinion in the states. And what I find really alarming, frankly, from some of the Republicans in Congress is that they want uniform solutions from the federal government that they want, rather than saying, no, wait a second, if we are the federal government, we need to be okay with stepping back and saying, some states may not go along with what we think, but that's the prerogative of their citizens and their representatives. And we have a diversity in some issues, but in a lot of others, and like you said, a lot of this is tied to money and it's incentivizing states for this kind of unanimity. I don't think that that's a good solution at all. And as Republicans and conservatives, we need to push back on that. But real quick, where can people find Yes Every Kid and support your work?
Oh, Jenna, thank you. You know, there may be people listening who want to be education entrepreneurs or learn about how they can support the work we're doing. YesEveryKidFoundation.org is the website. Click contact us and send me a message about what you're interested in as it relates to education transformation, and whether you are interested in being an education entrepreneur.
Awesome. Well, we will be right back with more right here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
You don't have to be an exceptionally talented person to be extraordinary. Living a meaningful life starts with making small but significant choices each day. This week on Pathway to Victory, Dr. Robert Jeffress continues his series based on the life of Elijah. It's called Choosing the Extraordinary Life. Learn how you can choose extraordinary all this week on Pathway to Victory with Dr. Robert Jeffress.
Weekday mornings at 6 Central on American Family Radio.
Washington Watch advances a culture where human life is valued and religious liberty thrives.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, host of Washington Watch, right here on the American Family Radio Network, inviting you to join us each weekend for the weekend edition of Washington Watch for the latest from our nation's capital on what is happening as it pertains to faith, family, and freedom. You'll hear from policymakers, congressional leaders, and others each day, 4 p.m. Central Time. Be there.
For nothing is hidden that will not become evident, nor anything secret that will not be known and come to light. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles conducted a study which showed a spike in heart attack deaths. The hardest hit group? 25 to 44-year-olds. Young people in this age range saw a 30% increase in heart attack deaths. The number is so astounding, even NBC's Today.com covered the story. The evidence has mounted so much that even Goebbels, Inc. outlets are beginning to report it. Florida Surgeon General Dr. Joseph Lodapo has already reported a 1,700% increase in vaccine-related adverse events. The nation must take heed.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner, or visit the podcast page at AFR.net. For more from Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Sometimes you see a win, a glimpse of God in this broken world. Preborn rejoices in the overturning of Roe v. Wade. Preborn's mission is to love and help women in unplanned pregnancies by offering them the truth to help them make the right choice by providing free ultrasounds. You see, when an expectant mom hears her baby's heartbeat and sees the image of her baby on ultrasound, she's seeing a life created in God's image, and it's a divine connection.
And I got to hear and see my baby for the first time. Hearing the heartbeat made me cry, and it was certain that I was going to keep my baby forever.
To learn more about Preborn's life-saving work, go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com, or dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 and say baby. All gifts are tax deductible. Your love can save a life.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And of course, we've been following this story out of East Palestine, Ohio. And yesterday, President Biden went and visited Ukraine. And of course, you know, the memes are suggesting that maybe Ohio needs to identify as Ukraine so that Joe Biden and, you know, all of the Democrats will actually pay attention to it. And of course, Biden was slammed for a message he wrote to Zelensky in his guest book. And so I tweeted out just moments ago that Biden celebrated a late Valentine's Day with his real Valentine, Vladimir Zelensky. So, but looking at, you know, this entire scope of what's going on in East Palestine, Ohio, and what's going on with the greater scope of, you know, of climate issues. And I've actually been really surprised that the Biden administration is kind of ignoring this and not actually taking this as a pretext and a reason to simply declare that there is a climate crisis on some sort of basis of, you know, looking at this kind of giant mushroom cloud that has billowed out from now Ohio into Pennsylvania, now into New York, across the border of Canada. So my friend Vivek Ramaswamy is joining us now to give his opinion on climate change and also climate really as a religion now to the left. And of course, Vivek is strongly considering mounting a presidential campaign for 2024. And I'm all in with that. I think it's a great idea. So Vivek, welcome back. And, you know, I want to talk about this whole idea of climate being a religion.
Climate has become a religion, Jenna. I think that, you know, Blaise Pascal actually said it really well. He's a famous mathematician and scientist, of course. He said that if there's a God-sized hole in your heart and God doesn't fill it, then something else will instead. And so instead of Christ, we now have climate. And I think that that's actually what's going on here, is that there's this hunger for purpose and meaning at a moment where we've lost the kinds of things that used to give us that sense of purpose. We don't lose the need to believe in a God. We just relocate that to something else. And I think the zealotry of climate change on the climate religion actually, funny enough, has nothing to do with the climate itself. It's sort of as much as the Spanish Inquisition had to do with Christ is what the climate religion has to do with the climate, which is to say nothing at all. It's really just a form of punishment. And in this case, self-punishment and self-flogging, because you know, I can almost prove that to you, where the climate religion does not care about shifting oil production or coal production to places like China on the other side of the world. It completely turns a blind eye to that, yet worries incessantly about reducing production here in the United States. Why is that? It tells you what this agenda is about. It's about America flogging itself, wearing a hair shirt for its own successful past, for its own exceptionalism. And the other piece of proof I like to sometimes give my friends who I'm debating on the other side here, who adhere to this religion without, while thinking of themselves as secular, they're actually just practitioners of this religion, is taking the climate religion's hostility and the ESG movement's hostility. The ESG movement is the apostle of the climate religion in capital markets, but its hostility to nuclear energy, which actually, if you really even did subscribe to all 10 commandments of this religion, you would at least be embracing nuclear energy as the best known carbon-free form of energy production known to mankind. And yet its hostility to nuclear energy reveals again what's going on, which is that nuclear energy might be too good at solving their problem, which means they would have no more excuse for flogging themselves and wearing a hair shirt. And so I just think that in many ways, it's once we wake up to that reality, I think we can then see the path to how we go about abandoning it, which is what I do think the leadership in this country absolutely needs to do without apology, abandon this religion, which is bordering on an establishment clause violation when the government embraces it to the extent it does. But as you can tell, I'm pretty passionate about this topic, Jenna, because it goes to the heart of American identity itself, but also American prosperity and even American competitiveness versus China. And once we wake up to the fact that we're actually just participating in a cult, I think we can find a better path forward.
And I think you expressed that so perfectly, Vivek, that this is a new religion to the left. And it's true that everyone has a religion, even if they call themselves secular, even if they call themselves atheist. They may not believe in the one true God, but they do believe in something. And everyone has to answer life's most basic questions, and everyone needs to find meaning and purpose in their lives. And so if we excise God from society, then we will replace God with some other God substitute. And I think we've also done that not just with climate religion, but also with political religion. And we're seeing a lot of that in the type of cultist cult following of the two parties. We're seeing that in America with big government, to say that if we don't have church and family in their roles as God intended, then we have abdicated that role and responsibility to the state.
Amen. I really like that. And I think you're right. I mean, this is something about human nature. This is hardwired. I mean, even if you look at religious texts itself, look at scripture. You know, when Moses came down from the mountaintop, his people had already built the golden calf, right? What was it that caused the Israelites when they're lost in the desert to want to go back to Pharaoh? I mean, I think that there is something innate in human nature that wants to bend the knee to something greater. And I think even if you're secular, even if you're atheist, that you can at least acknowledge that that is a role that a belief in God plays, is to fulfill that basic human psychological need, which is what makes us human. Animals don't have this, right? What separates human beings from beasts is our ability, our need to believe in something greater. And I think that it is no accident that you see the rise of these secular religions precisely at a moment in our national history when the things that used to fill that void, from faith to patriotism to family to hard work, have disappeared. It's no accident that COVIDism and climatism and transgenderism and wokeism fill the void. It's not an accident. Now, I will say I have a criticism for Republicans on this too, though, Jenna, is, you know, we are criticizing the left's embrace of this secular religion, and so be it. But here's the thing. There's an asymmetry in this. I think when conservatives embrace classical religion, the left has no apology and no restraint on going after it and pummeling it into the ground. Whereas I think a lot of conservatives, let's just take this climate religion issue, I think that they play with kid gloves when it comes to treating the other side's embrace of this religion, because they realize it's a sacred cow they've embraced, right? And so I think a lot of Republicans resort to meek arguments. Well, it's about time horizon. We're not going to make that transition so quickly over just 10 to 20 years. It could take 100 years that we're still on fossil fuels. But in making those kinds of meek, rather lame arguments, if you ask me, I think what they're doing is implicitly validating the tenets of the religion itself. And what I think we need to actually recognize and see truth. What is truth? Truth here is the reality that climate-related disasters have gone down 98% in the last century precisely because of greater use of fossil fuels. What is truth? Truth is the fact that eight times as many people die of warm temperatures, of cold temperatures than warm temperatures, and the best solution to all temperature-related deaths is greater abundant, more access to fossil fuels. And so I think that we need to be saying these things out loud in the open, not implicitly making incrementalist arguments about time horizons, and recognize that the actual truth of the matter is that the very policies this religion is advancing are going to destroy the very human experience that it claims to protect. And I just think that I would like to see Republicans do better at unapologetically embracing truth rather than making just incrementalist arguments that automatically validate the suppositions and the core tenets of this cult on the other side, because you know the other side in return isn't returning that favor when it comes to embracing classical religion either.
100%. And this goes back to our embrace of relativism as a cultural worldview, and this notion that the left has pushed really onto Republicans and Christians and conservatives to say, well, it's my truth, not the truth. It's my truth. And so you need to respect and tolerate whatever it is that I believe. But then on the flip side, tolerance only goes one way. And so then the left will advocate and advance their religion, even to the point of government compelling everyone to participate and buy into their lies, if you think of wokeism as a religion as well, and this whole idea that somehow it is against, you know, the Equal Protection Clause, or it's somehow against civil rights to call a man by masculine pronouns if he says, well, no, I'm a woman, right? And we are forced then as truth tellers to buy into that lie. And yet, when we say, well, that's even embracing a relativistic worldview, just saying, well, hang on, that's not my truth, and you need to respect my truth, which is the Christian conservative biblical worldview. Even on that level, they will not allow us to have even a relativistic framework. And so I think you're absolutely right that we need to reject that, and we need to not play on their playing field, and we need to say, No. We're fighting for the truth, which is advancing the truth of the biblical worldview and pointing out all of these other false religions. But how do we have that as a national conversation when, of course, the immediate pushback is, well, you're just a Christian nationalist. And, you know, we can't have that because, you know, Christian isn't anywhere in the Constitution.
Well, I'll make it really easy for you, Jenna, and for one. I am not raised Christian. I'm religious. I'm Hindu. I went to Christian schools. I'm educated in the Bible. But I stand for exactly everything that you just said, because I believe in this concept of objective truth. And you know what? The difference between a religion and a cult is a cult has not withstood the test of time. And I think that goes for wokeism. It goes for this new radical gender ideology. It goes for this new climate religion. But I would say that embracing and talking more openly about God without apology, about faith, and about national identity, I think is something that conservatives are willing to do in terms of everyday conservatives. But in terms of Republican politicians, sometimes they get shy about it. And so I think it comes down to the fact that the Democratic politicians who are elected are completely willing and already are demonstrating that they're carrying out the wishes of their woke base. But I think a lot of Republican politicians, when it comes to the touchy issues like dismantling climate religion, like dismantling the woke religion as manifest in modern affirmative action, start to deal with it in kid gloves and make these sort of empirical, incrementalist, and defensive arguments, when in fact they need to channel the actual spirit of the people who they represent. You talked about civil rights, for example. I mean, we talked about climate religion. The woke religion is just a parallel version of this, where I'm a fan of equal equal access to civil rights, okay, equal enforcement of civil rights. If wokeness really is a religion, and I think it meets the Supreme Court's definition of what counts as a religion to a T, I laid this out in my first book, Woke Inc., then what that means is that the Civil Rights Act's prohibition on discrimination on the basis of religion actually prevents an employer from forcing an employee to bending their knee to that religion. Yet that's exactly what these modern DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion trainings in corporate America do. You have to sign on the dotted line. That's a form of bending your knee to a new religion. That's a civil rights violation. I think the next president of the United States can direct the Department of Justice to end that practice, not by passing a new law, but just by even-handedly enforcing the civil rights statutes that are already on the books. And for that matter, I think Republican embrace of civil rights ought to be a good thing, which is actually talking more about how political expression itself ought to be a civil right, to say that if you can't fire somebody for their race or their sexual orientation or their religion or their national origin, then you should not be able to fire somebody for being an outspoken conservative either. And I think in these ways, right, even if you think about hearkening back to the message of the Civil Rights Revolution, Martin Luther King, the idea that you get ahead in this country not in the color of your skin but in the content of your character, I think we in the conservative movement, I think Republicans can embrace being the party of civil rights, but actually applying those civil rights even-handedly, not bending my knee to climate religion, not bending my knee to woke religion, being able to speak my mind freely without fear of putting food on the dinner table, getting ahead on the content of my character, not the color of my skin. These are basic civil rights concepts that I think we got to be shy and unapologetic as embracing. But you know what? There's a part of Dr. King's message that the Republican Party stands for, and the other side doesn't get a monopoly on being the standard bearers of quote-unquote civil rights. To the contrary, I mean, the Republican Party can be the party of civil rights in the year 2023.
100%. And I think if we contextualize civil rights and truly understand that this is about treating everyone fairly on the basis of merit, not identity politics, like what we're seeing in the current Biden administration, that basically all of the prominent hires or a lot of them were hired on the basis of diversity and inclusion rather than on the basis of merit. And you're seeing that really evidence itself in how poorly the administration is handling so many things. And I think it's worth saying as well, Vivek, that you know, the 14th Amendment has an equal protection clause, not an equitable protection clause. And there's a huge difference.
I love that. Yep. I think this culture of, I mean, everything we've talked about, right? Truth over relativism, equality over equity, democracy over aristocracy. I mean, these are basic rules of the road. These are basic ideas that maybe back in the 90s, Democrats would have said they stood for instead. Well, you know what? It's a different world today. I think this can be these basic principles that set the nation in motion can actually be the North Star for the future of the GOP. And I'm glad people like you are actually talking about it unapologetically. What we really need is more elected officials and elected Republicans being able to do so without apology as well.
Yes. Well. Hopefully we will see you very soon jump into your own elected official race. But, you know, staying tuned for that potential announcement. But Vivek Ramaswamy, really appreciate it. How can people contact you and support you?
I appreciate that. You can see VivekRamaswamy.com for my books. But beyond that, stay tuned. And we'll be
all right. All right. Sounds good. And I look forward to having you again. And that we are all out of time here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. I will see you tomorrow. Make it a great day.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.